This is the European edition of Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show. We bring you the European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders innovating the rapidly evolving fintech scene today. A truly localized podcast with both English and local language content with some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in the fintech sector globally. Join us every week as we explore what makes the European Union a phenomenal proving ground for many of the fastest growing fintech plays in the world today. Okay, let's roll.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 69 of Breaking Banks Europe. I'm your host, Ajit Tripathi, and today we have two exceptional guests with us, Tinashe Ruzane and Sarel Tal. And they will be telling us all about embedded finance. You know, the one thing that we love to talk about in fintech is embedded finance. And today we're going to ask Tinashe and Sarel all about their journey and about, you know, what's really going on with embedded finance and what's in it for everyone. So Tinashe and Sarel, would you like to introduce yourself briefly?
Yes. Thank you. Tinashe, why don't you go first?
Sure. Thanks, Aro. So I'm one of the founders of Flex Club. Flex Club being a car subscription marketplace that allows our members to subscribe for a vehicle from one of our partners. And the nature of a subscription is that it's somewhere in between a short-term rental and a long-term lease as a alternative to vehicle financing. And we've been running this business now for just over 2 years, operating in South Africa and Mexico. So excited to be here and share more about our views and perspectives of the world.
Sarel?
Great. Hi, I'm Sarel, and I'm with Rapid. Rapid is a fintech as a service provider, which is basically another name for embedded finance, as we'll find out during this episode. We operate on a global basis and provide global merchants the access to the various financial services through our one global API.
Awesome. So the first question I have is, you know, not very nice. Is embedded finance just a buzzword, or is there more to it?
No, I think it's far from being a buzzword. It's a business that has been developing over the last few years, starting from different silo based financial services like payment as a service and credit as a service and insurance as a service, which was a separate service that was connected through an API to somebody's core platform as an add-on service, as an extension of the service. And what we see over the last few years is that these services become integrated into the services to improve the customer experience, to provide better integration and create new revenue streams and, you know, and shift of profit pools from the core service to the integrated service of, your core service. Was it a online music subscription or a ride hailing service, and the financial services that have been integrated. And I think the core drivers are, the need to differentiate your service. If you had a service in a very highly competitive market and you need to differentiate that service from your competitors, one of the ways to accomplish this was to integrate financial services into the service. The other reason was to enhance the loyalty and drive, I think, the lifetime value of your customers as you build the relationship with them. So I don't think this is a new trend. I think this is, if I can use the new term that was implemented during COVID, this is the new normal of the integration of financial services.
Right. And Tinashe, what's your view on embedded finance? I mean, is this a new thing, or is this just a new name for something we've been doing for a long time?
Yeah, I think I echo the sentiment. And actually, my perspective is maybe a little different, not necessarily coming from you know, a financially heavy, you know, background. I actually, Sarwel mentioned ride hailing, and I actually came from ride hailing world before we established this, and understanding how finance intersects with what we're ultimately building, having built our careers at Uber. And, you know, even if you look at the trajectory of Uber moving into, you know, payments and eventually looking at the prospect of other financial services, I think it reflects a trend that existed well before, you know, platforms like Uber were established. And, you know, we have taken a different approach to how we incorporate the, you know, financial services norms into what otherwise would have been a more traditional car rental product. So I think it's a reframing, if you will, now taking advantage of new technology to allow for, in our case, you know, bundling of financial services with a host of other products. You know, in the case of a subscription, it's, you know, a traditional vehicle finance or finance lease with insurance, you know, with maintenance coverage, and a host of other operational products that together make up a car subscription. So, I think it's not new, but I think the approach is fresh.
Yeah. So the way I think of embedded finance is that, you know, you have e-commerce or other sort of, you know, merchants. People who are effectively providing goods and services directly to people, and they are much more in control of the context information, right? What is the person or the shopper or buyer trying to do when they are actually doing something? And then let's say they're shopping on Amazon, and maybe they need some a loan, and sort of it's because you have this context information at that point, and the context information is not available to a bank. The bank knows you're paying for something, don't necessarily know what else is going on. So you kind of create a more interesting user journey, or a more, you know, context aware user journey for users by embedding a financial service. But there was this speech by you know, A16Z's Angela Strain saying every company will be a fintech company, and that I think got everyone excited. Is every company becoming a fintech company, really? Is that what's going on here with or is there a different direction here?
It's not that every company is becoming a fintech company, but every company are, you know, not every company, but many companies will need to integrate fintech-related services into their offering in order to differentiate and maintain the customer for longer term and increase their revenues from the customers. But on the other end, I think, you know, and what we learn from our customers is that these customers are good at what they're doing. You know, if you're into ride hailing or music or distribution of digital goods or an e-commerce provider, you're best at what you're doing. And, you know, the best use of your internal resources was to improve your core competencies and the core offering to your customer, while having the ability to integrate financial services as they become integrated into your services. So it's not that these companies will become financial services. You know, becoming a financial service provider will require regulation, licensing, you know, other areas of experience, anything from compliance to fraud and risk management and so on, which is, you know, in most cases, not part of the core competencies of these companies.
Yeah, so I are you saying that, and I don't want to put words or twist your words, but so there are a whole bunch of tech companies who don't necessarily want to do the hard work of banking, which is compliance, risk management, you know, all of the rule following hundreds of rules. We just want to sort of build the APIs and cool technical infrastructure and skim the cream off the top of the banking infrastructure, and banks do all the hard work. Is that kind of the architecture we're heading towards?
It's not a matter of utilizing and letting the banks do the hard work, but it's doing a different sets of work or different work that needs to be done in the process in order to provide these services. You know, some look at it, and it is, in certain cases, especially when you need to provide these services on a global basis, this becomes a significant heavy lifting operation in terms of licensing and compliance and integration. But it's just a different business, and you know, people need to, you know, continue and do the best they can in their own business rather than expanding into other businesses. If they, as long as they can receive all of the required services you know, the right grade of service, the level of service, you know, the right SLA, and obviously the right pricing. The other thing is, to as long as they can maintain the customer experience and the customer journey, which is very important for some of these customers. So it's no longer sending the customer to an external page or to a, you know, a hosted checkout page or to a different experience on somebody else's website. This is now all integrated into your product, into your customer journey, into your look and feel. No additional, you know, single sign-ons for the customer and so on. So there's many aspects to this.
So, I guess, Dinesha, in your platform, right, how do you sort of divide up the responsibilities towards the end user? I mean, which part of consumer protection or, you know, other sort of suitability or other compliance obligations are fulfilled by you versus, let's say, you know, an infrastructure provider versus, let's say, a bank? Right. So how who's responsible for what and how does this change the architecture of financial services?
Yeah, so we actually have two different frameworks, one in which we actually take more responsibility because the nature of the partner we're working with. So, for example, hypothetically, it's a debt fund. You know, a debt fund has different infrastructure and operational wherewithal to, say, a large leasing company or fleet operator. You know, one of our largest, you know, partners on that front is, you know, brands like Avis, you know, very different, you know, responsibilities that we have to work out between those two types of partners. And obviously, in the case of a debt fund, they're requiring us to then also, you know, support, you know, bundling in the insurance product, the maintenance product, or a maintenance plan, figure out the financing structure for that, and these other components. Where, you know, a company like Avis already has those components baked into their core business. I think where it's uniformly or consistently always our responsibility is when it comes to some of what Sarah's alluding to around, you know, onboarding, you know, of customers that would otherwise be a typical onboarding journey if you were basically signing up for a traditional financing product. So, you know, KYC, how do we do identity verification, credit verification, affordability verification, et cetera. Those are things that we have, to the same point, we have brought in-house to avoid having to send customers away from our environment or away from our ecosystem, which is, I think, from our perspective, you know, we're always benchmarking against the automotive industry. And if you think about, you know, what the construct has been for the automotive industry, it's always been you sell a car inside the dealer then moves, you know, transaction into finance and insurance, or what they call F&I. And from F&I, they then trigger, you know, a host of third parties to then get involved in that transaction to make sure that that customer can take the car off the lot. Where we're essentially trying to build all of that into one product. It's all virtual and it's all embedded so that the customer never has to leave the website. Almost to the point where we can actually complete the order, deliver the car to the customer's house in a matter of days without that added complexity. And that's why I say that, you know, early on, that embedded finance has always been there, because in the auto industry, they've always been doing this. They've always been, you know, selling. But I think the difference is it was quite fragmented. It was never, you know, leveraging technology in the same way we can today.
Yeah.
But I think this is true for a host of other products and services or consumer-focused products, you know, yeah, like ours. You can't imagine a world where we could sell the number of cars we do globally without vehicle financing. right. So I think, I think that's the way we kind of we view it today.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it, right? So what we are able to do now with sort of new technology, sort of cloud native architectures and APIs is essentially provide a seamless experience to consumers that wasn't possible before with all the paperwork and, you know, the legacy infrastructure. But I guess integrating finance into the consumer journeys, even if not as frictionless, has always existed in multiple industries. So a couple of related concepts, right? And in fintech, I mean, look, I love buzzwords because we get excited about, you know, one thing or the other, and suddenly everyone is going unbundling. Everyone wants to talk about, buy now, pay later. Oh, it's the best thing since credit cards, or, you know, or banking as a service. So we get all these funky buzzwords, and then everyone in fintech gets excited about this. This is the next revolution. So what's the difference between all of these things, right? What's the difference between, let's say, banking as a service or embedded finance? I mean, apart from the fact that it's not just banking. What's the big difference over there?
I think this more relates more to what I've indicated earlier, is more siloed kind of concept of services. You would because financial services or fintech services, you know, there's a whole host of different services, payment processing, card acquiring, card issuing, holding funds in custody, escrow accounts, collection across the world, disburse of funds across the world, credit. These are all different services. So historically, this was like banking as a service. I can hold the funds and provide you credit. This was payment as a service, and so on. And the embedded finance or embedded fintech is more into providing a broader set of fintech-related services under the same umbrella. So typically, enabling merchants to collect funds, hold funds, disburse funds, FX funds, and also get access to all of the auxiliary services like KYC, KYB, because this is all not only a solution that is relevant to the B2C environment, it is also relevant to the B2B environment. And, you know, we can cover this later because there's many use cases for embedded fintech when you are speaking into or going into the B2B environment.
100%. So I think that's a really, that's what you said is really valuable, right? Because now you're no longer thinking about financial services from a bank's or institution's point of view, saying, I call it insurance, or I call it the custody, or I call it something else. Now I'm thinking about the aggregate user experience, and the aggregate user experience at the point of interaction or whatever, it's the job that the user is trying to get done. And then you sort of say, look, what do I need to assemble into this experience from across the set of services that are available to me and embed that into a seamless experience? So that's a pretty powerful. Now, where is this working well, right? So, I mean, Tinashe, I'm sure you're doing it well. Who else is doing it well? And so what's a bad example for, what's an example of embedded finance done wrong?
That's a good question. As far as you know, it being done wrong is concerned, I think there are a few examples that we've looked to for inspiration on where it's been done right as a starting point. I think you know to go back to the central you know point being right now because of technology, you know, embedded finance is so much more possible and accessible for companies that may not have been in or more conventionally going down the traditional financial services you know path. But it's modular. All these components are modular, and I think that's where we're kind of seeing the creativity, you know, come through. Where you're seeing interesting applications of this modularity in different industries. It's like, well, you know, I can actually take this piece and this piece and this piece to now create an entirely new experience. So, for example, you know, I think we're not the first to look at car subscriptions. You know, car subscriptions are now a growing trend in the sort of financial ecosystem, at least asset financing ecosystem, but all the providers that are, whether they're operating in Europe, because we currently operate in South Africa and Mexico, so not necessarily you know, developed markets, but looking at car subscription players in developed markets across Europe, across the US, how have they approached you know, building this experience, knowing that these modular blocks are out there, so that it's significantly superior to the default. And that's true, you know, so you mentioned buy now, pay later. Obviously, you know, Klarna, Afterpay, et cetera, have also transformed or they've enabled e-commerce providers to transform, you know, that checkout because, you know, they could now plug into a module, being Klarna or Afterpay. And I think that trend is consistent across a number of, there are a lot of examples like that of, you know, whether it's an e-commerce platform or some other product or service incorporating different modules to make their product or experience superior.
Got it. Saral, where has it been done well and not so well from what you said?
Well, not so well, I don't want to go into, you know, disclosing names, obviously. But, the main things we see in places where this has been implemented not as well, I would say, is where the customer experience was not fully integrated. And the customer ended up going into a different look and feel process, a different journey. Than the standard journey that they had to go through in the, you know, core product offering. So these are kind of, you know, one area where things are not done well. The other area is when you look into global expansion and, you know, you build your customer experience. Let's say you're a European company, you build your customer experience along open banking and PSD2 in Europe, well into banking services. And now you expand into Latin America, or you expand into APAC. And, you know, the payment services there are based on, you know, wallets or cash, depends on the industry and the vertical. And the customer experience is completely different. And you need to take care, you know, of these aspects of the customer journey. In terms of use cases, I think some of the famous use cases where this has been well implemented is the Uber use case. Tinashe, I'm sure you're aware of that, where they've actually issued wallets to the drivers, enabling the drivers to collect their funds multiple times a day and cash out on a continuous basis, not on a monthly basis or a weekly basis, which was, you know, the customary in the industry before, all the way to the point where they issued a debit card on top of that wallet and enable their customers to use these funds through the debit card. Amazon providing credit or financing to the sellers, enabling not just to make more margins on the business, but also to increase the amount of business that these sellers are generating. So it's like almost double dipping into the business. Telecoms providing wallets and enabling people to use T-Mobile money, Orange money in Africa and places like that. So there's multiple areas where this have been implemented across, I think, all of the verticals, again, both in the consumer-facing services and B2B services.
Awesome. So this has been a very, very interesting conversation and great learning for me so far. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll ask our guests exactly how this whole new embedded finance thinking has impacted their business model.
The FTS Group builds innovation ecosystems. We engage incumbents, investors, entrepreneurs, technology partners, and regulators to build trusted and connected fintech tribes around the world. We firmly believe that innovation in financial services will truly improve people's lives. Learn more on ftsgroup.eu.
Hello, and welcome to episode 69, number 69 of Breaking Banks Europe. Today, we are having a very, very interesting conversation with Sarel Tal and Tinashe Ruzane. And they've been telling us a lot about embedded finance, which it clearly looks like is not a buzzword, and there is a lot to it. So Sarel and Tinashe, how has this new embedded finance thinking and the availability of technology impacted your business model and your own roadmap as a company, Sarel?
Well, for us, this is what we do. Maybe I will start with a short story.
Why don't you tell us?
Yeah, that kind of tells us how we got into being a fintech as a service or an embedded finance provider. Rapid is a relatively young startup founded in 2016 with the concept of providing world travelers the ability to use and convert their money into local currencies in a very effective way. The FX rates when, you know, travelers, whether business or consumer travelers, are charged when converting their funds are traveling into another country. It doesn't matter if it's by card or, you know, on street exchanges, are very high. And we have built this e-money or electronic wallet that enabled people to save the money in different currencies. And we were integrated into local ATM networks. So you can walk up to the ATM, identify the closest ATM through our app, walk to the ATM, punch in your phone number, get a one-time password, and just cash out in local currency without having to pay these heavy FX fees. So we built out the operation in the UK, received the UK license. Everything was going good. We said, okay, we're now ready to expand into additional markets. You know, we're looking at additional markets, and we said, now this is a heavy lifting experience. It took us like more than 6 months to build the business in the UK. If we want to go into another market, it'll take us another 6 months or 9 months. You know, this is not going to scale around the world. We started looking around for a company that will provide us this ability to connect into the local financial services by an API, and we just couldn't find one. And at that point, we said, hey, you know, this is a greater business opportunity than a consumer-facing application. And we converted our business and restructured into, you know, what Rapid is today. So we are actually providing and building our service on top of, you know, the ability to provide fintech as a service across all of the different verticals associated with fintech services, you know, the collect, the holding and custody accounts and e-wallets, the disburse, the issuing of debit cards, credit cards, and so on.
And what's your approach to building this? Are you working with, let's say, insurers, asset managers, banks who have sort of those regulatory permissions in the background to provide the backend infrastructure? Or are you building some of this yourself in terms of licenses and infrastructure? Or are you sort of providing mostly, let's say, a message bus type of infrastructure to allow, let's say, commerce providers to integrate with the financial service providers and purely playing a technology provider role?
No, this is a good, very good question. Providing just a technology layer will not enable our customers to expand, you know, quickly enough across the world. So we have built a full stack solution, which is not only the technology stack, it's also the licensing stack. So we hold licenses across the world with our own Rapid entities in the different territories, all the way from APAC to Europe, to Latin America, to the Americas, where we are able to not only provide a technical interface, but also to collect, hold, and disperse the funds. So we actually touch the money. We receive the funds, we hold the funds, we disperse the funds for our customers as part of our service.
And does that also bring the full weight of, you know, prudential rules in terms of capital reserves and so on and so forth?
Indeed. And this is why we went through a significant large financing rounds to, you know, to provide us with the ability to support these services to our customers. But in addition to that, to this, there are services that we are providing to our customers through APIs into third-party providers. Based on our licenses, we're not able to provide credit or to pay interest on funds that are held. And so we're actually opening up our network to third-party providers to provide additional added value services to our customers through these APIs. So we're not only an API-based service, we're not only a fintech as a service, we're also an ecosystem for additional financial services.
That's fantastic. So Tinashe, what about you? And how do you see yourself in this stack of, you know, commerce versus infrastructure versus actual regulated banking, insurance, and other financial services?
Yeah, I guess it's also useful to kind of highlight, you know, our origin story and how we kind of landed here to begin with. Obviously, we landed on the insights from the vantage point of being within Uber, being within the ride-hailing space, and trying to design products with banks, leasing companies, rental companies, manufacturers, and realizing that part of the reason why, you know, more assets couldn't get in the hands of folks in the driver community was there was a break in the underwriting process, meaning that there was a limitation on how people could access. But also, even if you had thought progressively about underwriting, risk shouldn't have been thought of as a once-off measurement, but the portfolio should always be measured on an ongoing basis. So we felt that there was an opportunity to think differently about underwriting and risk management more broadly. And that's how we then landed on designing this as a marketplace where we could work with the industry, whether that be, you know, a bank or a debt financier, or whether that be, you know, a leasing company or car rental company, to then add these other layers of the stack, if you will, to unlock increased access to cars, not just for ride-hailing drivers and not just drivers in the on-demand economy, but potentially for a wider host of customers that that may have been excluded. And I think the key thing for us was how we approached the design of this risk management layer. You know, so speaking about the different layers, so for example, you know, open banking being something that's quite novel, you know, realizing that inherently that's going to be something that's pervasive in emerging markets as well eventually, but then discovering that there are players out there that allow us access to bank transactions to assess affordability, allow us access to, you know, credit bureau data, data from the ride-hailing platforms or on-demand platforms themselves, and combining all of this into a unique view of underwriting that the banks, quite frankly, are just not, you know, set up to build. This also because it's not their priority. And I think this is how we started, and then kind of added the other layer of, you know, managing risk on an ongoing basis. So it's not just about getting a customer, you know, into an asset that's funded by you upfront, but just make sure that once they're in, they continue to be a good customer and continue to be, you know, the right sort of risk. And we incentivize that, you know, through our marketplace. So I think that's the way we kind of see ourselves evolving, continue to tap into these different modules that emerge that allow us to be at the cutting edge of this vehicle asset financing risk management space.
So what's really interesting about our show today is that, you know, Tinashe, you're focusing more on a vertical and saying, look, this is the segment we're going to go after. Whereas I guess Rapid, Saral, you're looking at this more as a horizontal play and, you know, sort of aggregating financial services through your infrastructure across the different, you know, whether it's banking, insurance, whatever else, and sort of be making these services available through your infrastructure and APIs to, you know, whichever users or commerce providers want to integrate or businesses want to integrate your services and offer applications on top to their users. So these are, you know, if I'm understanding this correctly, then these are slightly different business models. And in case of Rapid, that creates an interesting dynamic because, you know, on one hand, you're sort of partnering with banks and other sort of traditional financial, legacy financial services providers where necessary. And then you're also in some way competing with them where you're sort of starting to obtain your own licenses and, you know, and sort of starting to provide regulated services on the back end behind it. So what does this really mean for banks? I mean, and the current high street mega banks in Europe where, you know, we have some very, very large banks in each country, and they historically have had a bit of a monopoly on banking services. But now if infrastructure providers start to sort of compete for regulated services, what does this really mean for where we are going in terms of the industry structure?
You know, first, you know, the first part of what you just indicated, I think we have a good example here of, you know, one, a typical user, or Tinashe is a user, his company is a user of fintech as a service solution, while Rapid is a provider of a fintech fabric or fintech as a service. So this is kind of, you know, the differentiation that I would make between you know, the two companies. In terms of the banks, they will definitely need to rethink their positioning in the market. You know, we are seeing them already making, you know, many moves in the market. You see them less on the street. You see them on, you know, more and more going digital in terms of the services. There will continue to be services that they will be providing and continue to provide under their services that, you know, we as an e-money licensed institution will not be able to provide, like credit, like interest. So there is obviously room for these, you know, core banking services. We are still utilizing the banking network as, you know, I would say rails to move funds across the world. You know, and these will continue to play to play a role. But there are services, and especially these services that are heavily dependent on APIs and global APIs that will be provided by companies like Rapid, which provide this fintech fabric or fintech mesh on top of, or kind of integrate between the financial services, the core financial services, and the B2B and the B2C, you know, services, applications, and companies that provide the end user experience.
Right. So Tinashe, I mean, when you look at, you know, Rapid and other, it's quite a competitive space from what I know. Sort of, how do you say? How do you sort of compare different infrastructure providers and say, look, this service is better than the other?
I mean, for us, it's it often comes down to, you know, geographic coverage. You know, so do they have strong coverage in the regions in which we're looking to be strong? But also, you know, what does the rest of their customer portfolio look like? Does it include smaller businesses like ours, or does it actually focus on, you know, larger players, the Ubers of this world? So, I mean, as far as it relates to, you know, for example, payment processing, we know that there's a host of, you know, folks, and some of them maybe kind of go all the way through the spectrum, you know, from smaller players to larger, you know, So, I mean, in one of our markets, we're actually using Stripe. And so I think that's the way we kind of think about it. Like, what level of support would we get from that partner? And also, do we expect strong coverage in the regions in which we want to use them?
Right. So I think this is an interesting one in my mind. So in terms of industry structure, do we think banks are going to forward integrate and start to acquire, infrastructure providers, or if that's the right word, or it's the infrastructure providers who are so efficient and so much more competitive that they will start to backward integrate into banking services? Saral, where do you see this going? Are you guys going to end up buying banks, or banks will end up buying you guys? Sorry, it's a controversial question.
Yeah. No, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's a different layer. Banks, and at least most of the banks tend to be more local. And because they're heavily regulated, this limits their ability to provide services on a global basis. Mm-hmm. Rapid, as an e-money licensed institution, which is a somewhat lighter regulation, enables us to move quickly into additional territories. Going back to what Tinashe said earlier, I think one of the differentiators is the ability to provide the services on a global basis. And this is something that we are, as Rapid, trying to achieve, or has managed, I would also say, to achieve by having local entities in the different regions with the local regulations, enabling us to move these funds between the regions, but also to integrate locally into all availability, local payment methods, local disbursement methods, and so on, issue cards, on a local basis. So if you work with a global company and they want to issue cards in Europe, they want to issue cards in Latin America, they want to issue cards in APAC, this is a different infrastructure that you need to build, not only from, technical infrastructure, but also regulatory infrastructure, infrastructure relationships with, the schemes, Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. And these are, really heavy lifting processes that you need to go through. So I think, these are different layers. There is strong integration between the layers. There is overlap in certain areas. But for, probably the next 10 years, these will continue to be different layers.
Got it. And how do you benchmark yourself against your competitors? So let me just rephrase. What does it take to win in your business, in the Rapid business, Sarah?
Well, there's two things the way we see it. One is the global reach, especially as we are targeting global brands, global merchants. We need to be able to support them the same level of service, grade of service, same customer experience, customer journey across the world. This is one thing. The other is the ability to normalize the customer experience across the different territories. So customer who ends up paying with Ideal in the Netherlands or Boleto in Brazil or another payment and method in Japan needs to go through the same experience on the different marketplaces, the different vendors that use our services, and the ability to keep this very simple, not add additional steps into the process, the ability to best utilize the data that is available on the merchant side with the data that we require to execute on the financial transactions. So these are kind of the areas where we differentiate. In addition to the ability to provide SLAs, which is very important in this business.
Right. SLAs, so there's a lot of systems integration to this, right? And you kind of have to have the technical excellence and this sort of the efficiency to really get asset turnover out of being a really, really good, integrator and make sure the data is correct and make sure you have robust, resilient infrastructure that provides good experience both to the backend banks and whatever, but also the users and sort of fintechs that are using your APIs. That's really, I think, requires a lot of excellence, both technical and operational. So I don't know how you guys do it, but whatever you guys are doing is awesome. Now, Tinashe, so from your perspective, how has this new embedded finance movement really helped you focus more on your business? Or, how are you sort of using this new architecture of financial services to just do a better job for customers?
I guess it allows us to focus on higher order customer experience problems. you know, versus having to be drawn down to infrastructural, financial infrastructural issues that we can now rely on our partners to solve and rather, you know, plug into their solutions. So it's really how we orchestrate, you know, the consolidation of all these different modules to create a superior experience. And I think we wouldn't have been able to do that had we, you know, had to go through the process of, you know, going through regulatory compliance, you know, even building the technology solutions themselves. I mean, to Saurav's point, one of the things that I think is incredibly powerful is the fact that it's modularized in this way also just means that we can build very differently. You know, so we are a Netherlands-based, you know, platform. We build and manage the platform in the Netherlands. And administer the business in the Netherlands, but our customers are in South Africa and Mexico, you know, paying us in rands and Mexican pesos. Mm-hmm. And that already creates, you know, if you think about how we would have achieved that, you know, 10 years ago, I shudder to think what that possibility might have looked like. But now it's certainly possible with, you know, with players like Saurav. And when we think about, well, let's focus on unlocking and switching on to the Philippines, for example, you know, that's now possible because we have, you know, partners like that allow us to focus on what we do best, relying on their modules to support us.
I really like this way of thinking about embedded finance, right? So you kind of divide up the stack of between the consumer and the and regulated institutions, and then everyone does what they're really good at. Everyone sort of, you know, whether it's expertise in credit and lending, expertise in payments, expertise in sort of serving the end customer. Everyone kind of starts to do what their expertise in operating the technology and infrastructure and systems integration and just incredibly efficient operations. So everyone starts to really get great at what they're great at. And that sort of takes out a lot of the cost to the customer and improves the user experience. So this is not something I had thought about, and that's pretty profound. Now, so just two more questions as we come to the end of this discussion. What do you need from regulators to make your and the users' lives easier? Do you think regulators are sort of taking advantage of this opportunity? Do they need to do anything at all to sort of respond to this trend, or is everything fine as it is?
But I think one of the challenges that we're facing is baseline requirements across the different regulations, the different territories. Just look at what's happening now between the UK and Europe with Brexit. And the mess that this is creating, and the licensing requirements, which, you know, drives businesses like us and our customers crazy. And this is just Europe and, you know, greater Europe, I would say, now providing these services and, you know, compliance services, KYC, KYB, underwriting services, you know, across different territories, you know, just
absolutely crazy. You know,
exponentially explodes. And on the other hand, we do see areas like open banking in Europe that are enabling us and, you know, companies like Rapid and our customers to enjoy access to the data and, you know, by that provide better services, more cost-effective services to our customers. So actually we are seeing in many areas around the world, regulators moving into opening up, you know, the networks, enabling access to the customer data, to the customer's financial data. But again, if I could ask something from the global regulators is more coordination and alignment in their requirements.
Right. Yeah, and by the way, how about embedded regulation, right? I mean, embedded compliance, so that you don't have to hire four audit firms to look at what's been done every year, and you kind of have these APIs coming in from regulators, which are sort of harmonized data standards that are shared across, you know, European regulators at the minimum. And you sort of have a consistent implementation of rules where you don't have to have different KYC requirements, all of the European territories and so on. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice if you could just, you know, have embedded, maybe I should start a buzzword, you know, embedded regulation or embedded compliance and not just embedded finance, because regulation and compliance are so fundamental to everything we do in this space. Tinashe, what about you? Sorry, I got a bit passionate about that.
No, it's a great point. I mean, ultimately moving towards, you know, greater coordination, you know, between regulators in different territories facilitates. Yeah, exactly. It facilitates greater speed. Right. You know, and I think that's the key. You know, if we want to serve more customers and serve them, you know, better, you know, that's how we enable that. And so I think moving towards, you know, a universal layer of regulations where there's some consistency, I mean, I just as a user of obviously, you know, some of these financial services, you know, modules, if you will, it just unlocks an entirely different roadmap, you know, for us. If we know that we can easily switch on different territories, regulatory environments, you know, at I guess just with the flip of the switch.
So it's an API call, the same thing, right? I mean, that'd be pretty cool.
Amazing.
Yeah, amazing. I think we know what to call the FC about and say, look, guys, just turn everything into APIs and we'll just plug them in. Anyway, so the last question I had is, you know, for sort of people getting into fintech or sort of who have been around fintech for a little bit of time, but or are trying to build a career in fintech or looking to start or become entrepreneurs in the space, if they want to sort of take advantage of the opportunity that, you know, embedded finance provides for the next 5-10 years, 5 years is long enough, what should they do? Just new people getting into as entrepreneurs or employees, where are the, what's the big idea? How can they learn more and capture the opportunity personally? What would you advise people to do?
I think the opportunity in embedded finance is more on entrepreneurs that are building either consumer-facing services or business-facing services. And they, you know, the ability they now have to integrate and utilize these services that were never available to them at such ease. So I think the opportunity is there. The underlying infrastructure, you know, and the basic building blocks are here. And now we need to see more businesses integrating these services into their core services. And that will drive the next phase, I would say, of embedded finance. You know, the ability to offer better services, better solutions, increase your margins, utilizing these fintech services. I think this is the key. So it opened up greater opportunities for people outside of the fintech area to utilize these services and build, you know, differentiated services and solutions.
Yeah, this has been, you know, thank you so much, Saral and Tinashe. This has been truly informative for me and educational. And I hope it's the same for our audience. I mean, this is a fundamentally new way of thinking about financial services. And, you know, if you're an engineer, you kind of get it instinctively, right? Which is, oh, yeah, I'm just assembling components into a really cool solution, which I couldn't do 5 or 10 years ago, because now I have all of these APIs. I have the underlying scalable, horizontally scalable infrastructure, which is cloud native. And I have, you know, vastly more efficient automated operations with all of the monitoring and all of the services that, you know, the tech industry folks are often used to if you work for a Google or a Netflix, but you don't see a lot of that sort of, you know, architectural beauty or clarity in the legacy banking space. And once you start to think of banking as an engineer and say, you know, what finance as an engineer and start to assemble things into consumer experiences, and obviously focusing on experiences and design is critical to all of this. That just opens up enormous new possibilities. And I think, you know, thank you for coming on our show today and first of all, educating me and hopefully also, you know, informing our audience with some possibilities that I hopefully will inspire, you know, entrepreneurs and engineers and designers and everyone else to create things that weren't possible before. I'm really grateful for this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ajit.
Thank you, Ajit. Pleasure being here.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Banks Europe, a Provoke Media podcast in cooperation with FinTech Stage. Don't forget to tweet us out, shout out, or post to the team at Breaking Banks EU on Twitter. If there's something or someone you'd like to hear on our cast, let us know. See you next week on Breaking Banks Europe.